Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Wednesday, November 29th, Joe was joined by Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Carius-Kelly, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Robert Griffin, Preceptor in Public Speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
We can talk about the individual hostage issue, but I think I'd like to go a little broader than that initially and talk about the president of the United States. There was an interesting article in the New York Times yesterday with a headline that says, "Biden navigates divisions over Gaza inside the White House and beyond." President Biden is facing deep anger over his solidarity with Israel among supporters and even some staff members who have said they feel disenchanted with the president. This comes as many are hailing the president for his diplomacy and working on this situation, and yet there still is anguish within those in the closest circles of the president of the United States. Just weeks after the start of the Israel-Hamas war, Mr. Biden had invited a small group of prominent Muslim Americans to the White House to discuss Islamophobia in America. The participants were blunt with him, according to four people who were in attendance. They told him that his embrace of Israel after the October 7th terrorist attacks was seen by many as permission for Israel's bombing in Gaza. They said the president's statement, casting doubt on the death toll among Palestinians, was insulting. And they said the fatal stabbing of a 6-year-old Muslim boy outside Chicago was just one devastating result of the dehumanization of their community. The private meeting, which had been scheduled for 30 minutes, stretched to over an hour, attendees said. Mr. Biden waved off aides who tried to pull him out of the room, and he listened to the criticism and shared his own experience with loss and grief. The gathering ended with Mr. Biden hugging a woman who had lost her brother in an anti-Muslim hate crime several years ago, but the group left without one thing that it had come for, a promise for Mr. Biden to call for a permanent ceasefire. The meeting was a glimpse into a much larger task that Mr. Biden faces as he tries to navigate a deep anger among longtime supporters and even inside the White House, where some younger staff members, particularly those with Arab or Muslim backgrounds, have said they feel disenchanted with the president that they serve. Biden administration officials say the president's support for Israel's right to defend itself after Hamas's deadly assault is only part of the story. Increasingly, Mr. Biden has paired his words of support with more forceful calls for caution and the protection of Palestinian civilians as the death toll reaches catastrophic levels. I'll pause there in the reading of the Times account. Terry Gibson.
Well, it is a tough time for Joe Biden, no doubt about it. You know, we live in an incredibly diverse country, more diverse than it's ever been, and not only are people taking the Constitution seriously when it says that we're supposed to be treated equal, they really are demanding that we be treated equal. Everyone is. And a president who puts himself in the spotlight to what appears to be showing favoritism to one group over another is always going to be in a situation where another group is going to be unhappy. I think it is very dangerous for President Biden to get any closer to Netanyahu than he already has, certainly publicly. Even that hug at the airport, I think, might have been a bit too far. The truth of the matter is that this president is going to need to develop a relationship with the Palestinians in Palestine, and especially with some version of the Palestinian Authority, if any version of a two-state solution is ever possible, which is what he continues to say he supports. So going too far to alienate Palestinians and show that strength towards Israel, it can be dangerous for him. And I understand he's walking a very tight line. I think that behind the scenes, he and his staff surely must understand this and must be talking to the various decision makers in those two factions in explaining their desire to bring them together somehow, especially within the Palestinian Authority. There is real work to do there to try to get a legitimate form of government established with a legitimate leader that can be part of rebuilding this dream of a two-state solution, which currently is non-existent.
Vera.
Yeah, so I think Terry is right. This has been a very difficult time for Biden for the simple reason that Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans feel used by the president to get their vote last time. They came out for him. They supported him. They believed that he really was a president to lead this country and potentially a better path forward for Israel and Palestinians. But he has been deeply disappointing to them. Actually, some of his commentary was considered extremely hurtful. He showed little empathy for any Palestinian concerns. He basically talked about Hamas as a terrorist group and supported fully all policies that Israel pursued. And he did not do a good job distinguishing between the general Palestinian community, Palestinian Americans, Arab and Muslim Americans who have particular feelings about what was happening. And he just, he burned some very important bridges, and I'm very glad to see that he stayed for a longer meeting, that he listened carefully, but he will have to do a lot more work to get Arab Americans to come out in this next election. They might just sit home and say, well, this is not our president. We thought he would advance our interests and perhaps consider us as human beings. And a lot of Arab Americans have begun to think that maybe they're just a people that do not have equal rights. And in that sense, I think Biden has lost a lot of credibility in particular states such as Michigan.
I have a lot of friends in the Muslim community, and I know that this moment has been very, very painful and hurtful for many, many people on all sides of the conflict. But here in the U.S., the rhetoric about Palestinian people and the way we've sort of grouped Hamas and Palestinians together, and really, I think, forgotten the very human side of the condition in the Palestinian territories. And I know that many of my friends are very hurt by the rhetoric, by many of the politicians, and I think Joe Biden's not doing himself any favors at this particular moment with that community.
Bob Griffin.
So I'm going to be a contrarian on the panel this morning, I guess. I actually think
Great.
That Biden is doing a lot of things really well. And he's being very cagey and smart about it. I think that every hostage that is released mm-hmm. owes Joe Biden a debt of gratitude. Mm-hmm. It's his diplomacy, the diplomacy that he is leading with his administration that has led to the ceasefire, has led to the continuation of the ceasefire, has led to the negotiated hostage release. I think that if he had backed away from Netanyahu, he wouldn't have been able to achieve what has been achieved. I'll also caution everybody to remember what October 7th meant to the Israeli people in the atrocities of October 7th. I think that the president has maybe been the only person who could have achieved what is being achieved right now. I listened to the comments about, well, you know, people may not go to the ballot box. If you think that Donald J. Trump is going to be a potential better president for you and for your cause, then stay home. With that said, I think the situation is still incredibly tenuous and complex. What I like about what I'm reading, not so much in the mainstream media, but in sort of secondary and tertiary medias, is that continued emphasis and push for not just a continuation of the level of aid, but an increase in aid to Gaza and to the Gazans. I actually think that Biden has been working successfully both in the foreground, but most importantly in the background.
I agree generally. I do think that his rhetoric could have shifted just a little earlier in the conflict, maybe before we stopped counting casualties, right? Like there was a moment where many of the world leaders started to kind of see the bigger picture, the humanitarian crisis, the devastation sooner. And I think if Biden had gotten on that train a little earlier, that he wouldn't be facing as much of this, I don't know, this criticism, yeah, if you will.
And you see, and I'm
even
not,
if that's just yeah. a few days, right? But right, every but second counts, every day counts. And
true, but my respectful pushback would be that Hamas has obviously diverted the majority of money that was going into Gaza for their own purposes, not for their population. The use mm-hmm. of their hospitals and mosques and even UN facilities as basically meat shields for their military operations is pretty mm-hmm. clear. I'm not sure that him taking a different tone any earlier would have resonated with Israel. And I just hearken back mm-hmm. to my own experience after 9/11 that comments, even right. months after 9/11 mm-hmm. coming out calling for restraint in yep. places like Afghanistan would have gotten you tarred and feathered.
Yes.
I think we in this country are missing the rawness of what occurred, the issues, what occurred to babies and to children, and the fact that Hamas is still holding a 10-month-old and a 4-year-old as bargaining chips, that resonates in Israel, I think, differently than it resonates here. Mm-hmm. So I understand what you're saying. I'm just not sure that he would have been successful as he did, and I think that coming out publicly and backing Netanyahu into a corner earlier would have run contrary to the success that he's experienced.
So I think in many ways there are aspects I think Nick and I would agree with you, and Terry probably as well, but because we're not denying that Israel has suffered a horrendous attack and suffering and an awful attack. Hamas, however, is a terrorist group, and we cannot assume to look at Israel and Hamas in the same way. A terrorist group will not follow rules according to international standards, but we expect Israel to do so. And I think many of us would say we're not surprised by the rage that Israel showed, because we expected that. And 9/11 is the right context here in terms of the anguish and the pain and the kidnapped people and their suffering and all of that is extremely raw. But we expect for Israel to behave in a different way. And we expected President Biden, at least, a few weeks into this conflict, and we expected President Biden to try to moderate Israel's behavior. And I think that's why we thankfully see this agonizing attempt, these negotiations behind the scenes to extend this, these pauses. If we don't call them ceasefire, we call them pauses. We hope to extend it again and again and again, because the horror that people have experienced in Gaza is, we continue to see, great suffering. And I think President Biden needed to acknowledge that suffering as well. And he did so very late. He didn't sort of talk about the human casualty. And, no, you can't just say, well, Hamas uses these people as, as human shields. We know that. It's a terrorist organization. ISIS did that. Do we then say we can't? It's just sort of like we have to recognize that there are more ways to deal with this than either taking one side or another. We have to figure out, we have to straddle a humanitarian-focused position more so, I think, in the White House. And he's begun to understand that, I think.
Bob, I'm interested in what you say, because I think I fundamentally agree with you. And it's this idea. I'm just curious to how much of the perception that we have and many of our panelists have this morning of how the president is handling this is based on past actions. And sort of a history as opposed to what has been actually done in and from the Oval Office since October 7th, 2023.
Yeah, I think certainly there is a large degree of pent-up frustration and rage. I will admit personally, though, Joe, I'm surprised at some of the demonstrations that I've seen in support of Hamas. I was out in San Francisco for Thanksgiving and witnessed elements of this where it's a full-throated support of Hamas. It's not an issue of humanitarian. It's not an issue of Gazans. It's a support of Hamas. And I was actually shocked given some of the speakers that I saw in the news out there that, you know, that I'm thinking, are you ignoring the murder of babies? Are you ignoring the rape of innocent hostages? I mean, and Vera, you're correct that there is two standards right now. There's a standard for Hamas as a terrorist organization, but Hamas is also the elected government. So there's a line there. I also think that we in this country missed a really important and telling element, Joe, that Israel actually declared war. Okay, you know, a declaration of war is very different than a lot of what you see with some of the other actions from IDF. That was done specifically and purposefully to flag for everybody that this was going to be different and the actions of the government were going to be different. You know, with that said, I'm sure there's going to be mail coming in saying that, you know, I'm a warmonger. No, I'm not. But I also sort of recognize that if I'm a policymaker in Israel, I don't have any good, many good tools, especially when their intelligence and our intelligence, which has been pretty much spot on, saying that the hospital is being used as a collection point for hostages, is being used as a command and control spot. I would argue that I will not be at all surprised if we find that the director of the hospital was not only aware but linked with this. So the complexities here are a lot deeper than what we're seeing in protests and counter protests.
I just want to really distinguish. There are obviously fringe groups that are coming out and demonstrating in support specifically of Hamas, but the vast majority of protests in this country and worldwide are in support of Gazans and Palestinians. And they are distinguishing strongly and vocally a distinction there that they are not in support of Hamas. And I don't think we should group all protesters into that fringe group.
I was just saying what I saw in San Francisco, which shocked me, but also looking at some of even within college campuses here in New York, you know, there's a confluence here that I think is really dangerous.
So I wanted to make two quick points. Putin was also elected in Russia, so just because Gaza has Hamas as elected government and then hasn't held elections since doesn't really carry much weight, because we don't think that we can punish all Russians for electing, you know, and re-electing a dictator when there are all kinds of mechanics in place that don't allow for an open election. And both Hamas and the Netanyahu government for a period of at least a decade have relied on each other to support each other's positions of strength. So this is really a moment where we should take very careful account of how Netanyahu as a leader of Israel has used strong man approaches to elevate himself and not addressed fundamental complications in this relationship or non-relationship with various Palestinian communities. And it is so tragic to see this outcome. And President Biden has the obligation, if he wants the United States to be an honest broker in the region at all, to try and renew a path towards resolving this conflict and creating a two-state solution.
Vera Karius-Kelly on the Roundtable panel on November 29th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, November 30th, Joe Donahue was joined for the Roundtable panel by former U.S. Congressman John Faso, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
The Elon Musk story, it's interesting, and depending on how you feel about Elon Musk, I think regardless of how you feel about Elon Musk, this is an interesting story and something that it gives you an idea into the mind and character of this particular individual. So this is an event that was the Deal Book Summit in New York on Wednesday. And Elon Musk hit out at brands that have pulled their advertising from X after he endorsed an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory on the social media platform. Mr. Musk apologized for the post at the summit, but said that the advertisers were attempting to blackmail him. His message for those brands was simple: don't advertise. And he used an expletive multiple times to emphasize his point. I'm sure your imagination can come up with the expletive. About 200 big advertisers, including Disney, Apple, IBM, and others, stopped spending on X rather than Mr. Musk after Mr. Musk agreed with a post that accused Jewish communities of pushing hatred against whites that they claim to want people to stop using against them. If the freeze continues, it could end up costing the company up to $75 million this quarter, according to internal documents seen by the New York Times. Although Mr. Musk acknowledged that an expanded boycott could bankrupt X, he suggested that the public would blame the brands rather than him for its collapse. Mr. Musk singled out Bob Iger, the Disney chief executive, who told the event earlier that the association with that position and Elon Musk and X was not necessarily a positive one for us, end quote. Mr. Musk said that in retrospect, he should not have replied to that particular post and should have written in greater length what I actually meant. Always helpful. Always helpful. Sienna?
This I will reply to.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
You're welcome. Basically, I think what you're hearing from Elon is a lot of frustration, because after he made that terrible post, terrible reply to a post, I will give him that. Then he went on his publicity tour to try to make amends, and I just don't think it was as effective as he thought it was going to be. And I think he's terribly frustrated. He has been, ever since he has taken over Twitter, it has been one debacle after the next. And by allowing anti-Semitist and racist. All to, he's highlighted them on X. I'm sorry, on X, and it has been very sad to see that a social media platform that is so influential around the world, and especially here in the U.S., has been tainted so poorly by this poor leadership. And I am just, I was hopeful when he stepped back a few months ago from X. We thought he was, that it would calm down a little bit and maybe it would be returned to what it was before, but obviously not. And I just think what we're hearing from him is terrible leadership and frustration because what he thought was his apology tour did not work.
Judy.
So anybody who relies on advertising revenue has had to face an advertising boycott at some point. This is a bit unusual because it's the reason for it was so outrageous, and the number of advertisers taking their ads and going elsewhere, because I think it's a larger issue too than Elon's tweets and retweets. It's the fact that he has allowed the platform to amplify so many conspiracy theories, lies. That is why they want to walk away. They do not want their brand associated with them. I would like to thank Musk because he has made X or Twitter, I still call it Twitter, so unpalatable to me that I don't spend as much time on it as I used to. I still have an account, but every third tweet is a quote, is an ad for a bad product that I have no interest in. It's just become less and less useful. Also, I looked at the tweet of him, or I looked at the video of him at the forum last night, and the man does not look well. The man is 52 years old and throwing around the F word like, you know, he's like a 12-year-old. I think the power and the money has gone to his head, and he has a reckless disregard for any sense of propriety. And I'm sure his shareholders have to be quaking in their shoes today.
I don't think I can add much to what Sienna and Judy just said. I mean,
are you on Twitter? Yeah,
I am not on Twitter.
Are you on TikTok?
No, goodness, no.
And how about Facebook?
But Ira.
Ira's on TikTok.
Elon Musk is obviously a brilliant man, and in this instance, he's a brilliant idiot. And what he, you know, look at SpaceX, look at Tesla, look at some of the enterprises he's been involved in. I mean, the SpaceX thing is remarkable. I mean, reusable rockets. It's truly he's one of those people that has an element of genius in him that enables him to do all these things. But he obviously hasn't learned some of the basics about putting a filter between your brain and your mouth and a filter between your brain and your Twitter finger, right. Because mm-hmm. It's just crazy that how he's walked into these self-inflicted difficulties after he probably overspent what he spent about $42 billion for Twitter.
Right.
And the market value of that company is certainly not $42 billion today. So I think he's made his bed and he's going to have to lie in it.
He's a very bad communicator. And his message last night was, well, don't blame me if the loss of all this advertising revenue kills the platform, because it's the advertisers that are killing us. We'll let the earth decide. It's just such arrogance, such a level of disdain for the world.
The earth decide. The earth is pissed.
Yeah, no, it's like the earth is on his side. He is such a great man that, you know, he speaks for the earth.
It really is crazy that you would basically tell the people that are paying for your company services, tell them that they're to blame for the problem. It's just doesn't make any sense. I mean, I think one of the hardest jobs in America is being a PR consultant to Elon Musk.
I was just thinking that.
Or his advertising sales executive.
Yeah, but it doesn't. I don't think there's any. It's a lot like Trump in the sense that there's no containing that. It's just he's going to do what he wants to do when he wants to do it, right. and there is no rounding that up and trying to make it
okay. It's so the second hardest job for a PR consultant. is to be a PR consultant for Musk. The hardest job would be for Trump. But
but the other thing too, which I just find I find interesting is that you wonder how it's going to end up. I mean, as you said, Sienna, a few moments ago, he steps away and you think, oh, all right, they're going to get their we'll get their act together. Somebody will, you know, say, hey, look, if you want to make money off this, you got to shut up.
Yeah.
And then you shut up and then maybe the money comes back. Maybe it doesn't. You don't know. But this can't be a plan.
I mean, he doubled down, right? And I would just like to make a PSA to say that. You know, you guys made this comparison to Trump. I want to say that people who drive Teslas do not necessarily support Elon Musk. Do not egg my car. Come talk to me instead. You'll see that we have a different position.
Well, it's different, right? I mean, there's a lot of things. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if
yeah.
you knew then what you know now.
Okay.
All right.
Yes, of
understood.
Course.
There's a
understood.
Lot of them out on the road. The Teslas are
there are a lot, and we do not necessarily fall in step with him.
We have Judy Patrick here, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and John Faso with us, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I wanted to get to this earlier, and I forgot when we were talking about Israel and Hamas. And so I would like to get back to this story. And this is about on Israel's war against Hamas. Senator Bernie Sanders is facing a backlash from the left. His base, his friends, his the people who support him, the progressive activists, are deeply disappointed in the Vermont senator, an icon of their movement, for failing to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. On a Democratic primary debate stage in Brooklyn in 2016, Senator Bernie Sanders caused a ruckus within his party when he rebuked Hillary Clinton for not mentioning Palestinian rights in a speech she made to a pro-Israel lobbying group. If we are ever going to bring peace to that region, Mr. Sanders said in remarks that drew cheers and applause from the audience, we're going to have to treat the Palestinian people with respect and dignity. He added, that does not make me anti-Israel. The comment delighted liberal critics of Israel's policies in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, and alarmed mainstream Democrats who were more accustomed to seeing presidential candidates compete to showcase their airtight alignment with the Jewish state. It was an early indication of what would become a profound divide within the Democratic Party over Israel, pitting young progressives and people of color against older, whiter, and more pro-Israel voters. And it positioned Mr. Sanders, the progressive icon from Vermont, on the leading edge of it. But years later, amid the latest war in Gaza that began after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, killing 1,200 civilians and taking around 240 people hostage, Mr. Sanders has found himself at odds with many of the same progressive activists and groups who powered his presidential campaigns and once revered him for his willingness to publicly question the actions of the Jewish state. While Mr. Sanders was one of the first members of Congress to call for a humanitarian pause in the war amid a catastrophic civilian death toll in Gaza caused by Israel's military offensive, he has rejected calls for a permanent ceasefire. Mr. Sanders and independent caucuses with the Democrats.
It's a tough political position for any politician to be in at this point, because there are so, it's a divisive issue and it's so nuanced. I think Bernie, it's true, he appealed to the younger generation of Democrats. That generation has gotten older since 2016.
Haven't we all?
And I think politicians are trying hard to acknowledge the dramatic needs of both sides in this conflict and to acknowledge the history. It seems like I think Bernie's being cautious. I think the fact that his there are progressives on the far left trying to get him to demand a permanent ceasefire. I mean, he is a politician. I mean, politicians get put in tough spots sometimes, and he thinks the diplomatic point to make at this point is to hold off on it. I don't relish him where he is, but that's the gig he signed up for. He has enough credibility. He has enough experience, and you know, how old is he? He's not worried about reelection, I'm sure. That he can withstand this. He could be a force to come forward and speak a voice of moderation and have all sides come to a better understanding of what's happening here and how we need to look forward and not focus so much on the past.
Sienna?
I think, you know, because what I'm looking at, I feel like I'm cool and I'm in the nose of what the youth is looking at, and they're on TikTok, and it's interesting to watch that they're actually talking about funding and who funds these Congress people and how that may impact what they're saying. And that's what I'm seeing when I'm looking through social media. And more importantly is I'm seeing the talks right now about who's going to vote for who in the upcoming 2024 election, right? And yes, whereas Bernie may be able to survive, we are not sure whether or not Biden will be able to survive based on where people stand today. I understand it's a year away, but I think there needs to be more education coming from the politicians. If this is your position, you need to explain more and extrapolate more about why you have this stance and the nuances of what's happening in Israel. I think when you see them standing, when you see people speaking out against, oh, Bernie didn't say enough, you know, necessarily, they're thinking that this means that you condone what's going on in Gaza. And I think there needs to be explanation that this is more complicated. We have to figure out what the end game is, like we were talking about, or what will be the implications of us stopping and doing a ceasefire. But I think the politicians fail when they fail to explain why they're against these positions. On these public forums, it's important that you go to social media and you make these explanations if you want to succeed in the next election.
Well, I think it's very clear that there's a division in the Democratic Party. Normally, we talk about divisions in the Republican Party, so this is a refreshing change for me. but seriously,
enjoy it.
Seriously, there are divisions that exist in the Democratic Party over this, and it basically skews younger, more progressive, often more minority groups within the Democratic Party coalition are not in favor of U.S. assistance to Israel. You're seeing this is going to play. That's one of the reasons why I think you're seeing the Biden administration put increasing pressure on Israel over this issue because of the political ramifications for Biden. Let's face it, Biden is really in the dumps in the polling that is taking place across the country. Most Democrats don't want him to run even because of his age. There's over 50% in polls that I've seen say they would prefer someone else. In fact, 60 to 70% of the general electorate would prefer both parties to have a different candidate for national office. And I've often said the party that picks someone else is probably going to be the one that wins. But you're seeing this play out also in a pivotal state like Michigan. In Michigan, where there's a large Arab-American population, particularly centered around Detroit, where Congresswoman Tlaib is from, for instance, this puts the potential of Biden carrying Michigan in doubt. It also puts in doubt the potential of Democrats holding on to the U.S. Senate seat that is being vacated by another Democrat this year. So recent polling I've seen said that Congresswoman Slotkin and former Congressman Mike Rogers are basically in a dead heat in Michigan. And so that's what's playing out. The polls and the politicians are paying attention to this, and the Democratic base is divided on this issue. And I think we're going to continue to see that division play out over the next few months.
John Faso on the Roundtable panel on November 30th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Friday, December 1st, Joe Donahue was joined for the Roundtable Panel by semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, president and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, Siena College professor of economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Albany Mayor, Kathy Sheehan.
The closure of the College of St. Rose in the city of Albany, New York, which not only is my alma mater, not only is where I went to school, I got a degree from, and taught for many, many, many years, but is a place very dear, near and dear to my heart. It's really, this news of the closure is, I think, obviously devastating on many counts. Devastating, certainly, for those who had an attachment to the college, but it's also devastating to the city of Albany as a whole because of many, many reasons, which we'll talk about this morning. There's no one better to talk about that with than the mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, who is nice enough to be with us this morning. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
Good morning.
Well, hello all. It's good to have you here. What happened?
Well, I wish I knew exactly what happened. I don't know the ins and outs of the decision-making and the financial condition of the College of St. Rose. It is an institution that has been part of Pine Hills neighborhood for a century, and I know that over the years, the school expanded. They acquired a number of properties and created a neighborhood-based campus that provided an outstanding opportunity for, I think, people to come and learn in a wonderful environment in a very walkable neighborhood. And it was, I think, one of the jewels of the city of Albany. And as people saw it expand, there was some controversy, right? There were folks who were saying you're taking property off the tax rolls. But really looking at it from an economic development standpoint, having a strong central college that was attracting students who bring their buying power and hiring professors and staff and other folks all helped the economic vitality of the city of Albany. And so it is something that came up for me very quickly. Did not learn that it was in the dire condition that it was in as far as on the verge of closure until very, very recent weeks. And so
within the last 2 or 3 months?
Less than that.
Okay. Yeah. So when the report came out earlier in the year that their financial position and their accreditation was precarious, it seems to me, and I don't want to cast blame on anyone, because I, like you, don't know exactly what was going on. But from looking into it, from our vantage point, I read that on Tuesday or on Wednesday, they're asking for the state and the city for financial help. And then on Thursday, they vote to close. So I don't know about you, but I mean, it takes me often 2 days to get to the bank to cash a check. So I just don't know how you expect that money to come in that quickly. And obviously it was dire. And so the big question for me then would be, why weren't the alarm bells, especially going for to the state and to the city, going off a lot sooner? Followed by my second question, which is, well, would it have mattered anyway? Because was the city in the position, was the state in a position to actually help a private college?
Well, look, I think I don't like when people Monday morning quarterback things that happen in the city. And
That's all we do in this show.
But I guess,
it's our job, Kathy.
I want to focus on solutions, so I hope we get to that. But I will tell you from a timeline standpoint, you know, the city and the county were approached about a year ago by the college to provide assistance for them to relay the turf field out at the Hoffman Complex, that the Palmieri Sports Center, that was part of a deal that was done with the prior mayor to create state-of-the-art athletic facilities, and they were really at risk of not being able to have a soccer season because of the condition of the turf field. And so we said, sure. And, you know, at the time, the college was saying this is really important for our athletes, for our recruitment of athletes, and we're just struggling financially, and so we'd love for you to help us with this turf field. So to me, that was not at all a signal that we're on the verge of closing. If we're going to replace a turf field, it seems like, you know, we just need some help with some of the extra stuff that would help us as we recruit students. And so the county executive and I found the funding, and we were able to make that happen, and we did a ribbon cutting out there just a few months ago. And so it really was not until October, middle of October, that I received a phone call saying, no, things are very dire, but we are pursuing a partnership agreement, and we think we're going to find a partner, and we're going to be looking for some financial assistance to bridge us to that partnership. And it wasn't until the Monday of Thanksgiving week that a meeting was called where that demand was made for a specific dollar amount, with the explanation that this money was desperately needed to prevent the school from closing. And so it happened at lightning speed for me, in a way that, you know, I think being part of many, many organizations, and Lord knows every organization has had challenges through COVID, and having to make difficult questions about do we tap into our endowment? How do we find funding? And you problem solve through that through a multi-year lens. And so I think for those who are feeling the whiplash, I'm feeling it as well. And it's heartbreaking, because I don't want to get into the conversation of what if, because I don't know the answer to that question. So now I want to focus on what now.
Okay, so I understand that, and we'll certainly do that. I am struck by the word you use, though, of demand. I mean, which means not with a gun to your head, but saying that we have a decision to make, and then, okay, you're okay, maybe there was a gun in the room. I mean, is that how it felt to you?
Well, look, I think that understandably, this was not something that anyone at the College of St. Rose wanted to see happen. It's not anything that any elected official wants to see happen. It's certainly not anything that the students, the faculty, the staff, I mean, those are heartbreaking consequences of the ultimate closure of this institution. And so I think it is an incredibly stressful and difficult time for everyone involved. And I sent a letter to the college explaining the challenges that we had legal. You know, there's a constitutional prohibition against giving a gift to a private institution, but talked about the possibility that the city could purchase a building for $5 million, lease it back to the school as a way of potentially helping them with their cash flow issue, and explaining the steps that would take. I would need council approval and bonding and all of that. So, you know, certainly wanting to be part of a solution, but based on the sense of what we were being told in that meeting, thinking that it was probably too late.
So, solutions. Let me ask you about that. So I assume at this point, while we can hope and pray that maybe there is a solution to keep the college open, but that seems like that ship has sailed. Am I right on that?
Well, the college has said that ship has sailed.
Yeah, right. So, which would give you the opinion that they were, I mean, obviously aware that they probably couldn't finish out. So when you say solutions, the solutions are what we do with the students, what we do with the faculty and staff, and, oh, by the way, the 87 plus, I've heard differing numbers, 87?
Buildings.
That are on the campus of what happens to that property.
Well, I think, first of all, for the students, that is clearly under my understanding of Middle State's requirements. That is the school's responsibility to find a place for each of those students to land. And what we have been told is that the school is doing that. With respect to certainly the staff, I've already said in a statement, and the county executive and I want to work with their staff to transition them to opportunities that are available both with the city, with the county, and other employers. We want to do all that we can to soften that landing. And I think, though, with respect to what happens with those buildings and with the programs going forward, if we elevate that conversation a little bit and talk about the fact that the College of St. Rose educated more teachers than any other institution in the state, and we need teachers, I think that there needs to be the creation of some sort of task force or working group to say, what are we going to do? I would imagine every school superintendent in the region wants to be at a table to say, what are we going to do? We have student teachers that come to us through the College of St. Rose, right, that become our pipeline for teachers. And so this is a broader question about workforce and teaching that we need to address and find a solution to. In addition to the campus, I understand.
Yes.
But that, I think, is a critically emergency level conversation that needs to happen, because this pipeline of teachers is going to evaporate at the end of this current
school year.
So I think that's a really urgent conversation that needs to happen.
So, by the way, and teachers are very important, and I know nursing is very important, but please don't forget the broadcasters.
Of course. The star broadcasters.
Mayor,
who have gone on to fame and fortune.
Mayor Kathy Sheehan is our guest. We have a wonderful panel here, and we'll get to them in just a moment. We're talking about the closure of the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, which has been around over a century and has been a vital part of this community and of this city. So when you say there needs to be this group that comes together, who leads that? Is that on your shoulders? Is that on the college's shoulders? Is that on the state shoulders? Is that should Aaron and I start calling meetings? What do we need to do?
That was not me volunteering. But no, I think, look, we have the good fortune of our assemblywoman who represents the
Pat.
District within which the College of St. Rose resides is the chair of the education committee at the state level. And so I don't want to presume what that is, but I think it is important that we have that conversation, because this certainly is going to have an economic impact on the city of Albany. We have to strategize with our police department and our fire department about how are we going to protect this large campus that presumably will be empty at the end of June. We have to strategize and plan around those types of issues. That's a given. But I think it is important to advocate for this broader conversation about just when we need to be gearing up for trying to recruit more teachers, we've lost a resource for training them.
There's a lot of questions, and obviously I'm just trying to ascertain a couple of things here. Have you had any personal conversations with Marsha White, the president of the college?
She certainly was at the meeting where the request was made for funding from the city and the county and the state, but I have not spoken to her since that meeting.
What about before that meeting?
As I said, I received a call in October, I think it was October 16th or 17th, where she shared with me that there was a confidentiality agreement. She couldn't talk about who the partner was, but that they were seeking a partnership agreement because the school was struggling financially and they needed a partner to be able to move ahead. And she was optimistic that partnership agreement was going to come to fruition and that she would be coming to us and asking for funding to bridge to that partnership. And so I wished her well and asked her to keep me, you know, up to date on what was happening. And then the follow-up was that meeting on the Monday before Thanksgiving.
So will you be at the town meeting today?
No.
Okay. I find it... So one more question on that, and then I promise we'll move on to other things. But is what you just described to us unusual in the sense of, would you have expected it to be different?
I would have hoped for it to be different.
Okay.
I would have hoped, because again, you know, when the news came out, we all saw the news, but again, you know, I'm on the board of trustees of Albany Law School, which is why I won't be at any town. We are inaugurating our new president and dean at Albany Law School. And Albany Law School went through some very difficult times when there was a huge dip in the number of applicants to law schools. And we had to navigate our way through it. And we explored partnership agreements. And we thought about what the future of the school would be. And we did all of that 5 years in advance of when our budget was telling us we were really going to be in trouble. And so knowing that we had 5 years out, we could be in trouble, we backed up and had a lot of really hard conversations. We looked at the school. We looked at what we were good at. We looked at who we needed to bring in. We brought in a dean. We were able. We looked at the need for increasing our endowment. And we actually got on a path where now, you know, academically, the caliber of our students is higher. We're meeting our goals for each of our attendance goals for our classes. And so, but it was challenging times, but it was years that we really looked at that, reached out. I'm not going to name the institutions, but we have a very strong relationship with UAlbany, for example, right now, where we make it much easier for their students to come right into Albany Law School. And all of that grew out of looking 5 years down the road and saying times are changing and we need to be prepared for it if we're going to survive as an institution.
And I know this, and I respect and agree with your wish not to do Monday morning quarterbacking. But for those of us who have had a close relationship with the college, you know, we knew that there was trouble. We knew that things weren't good. And I agree with you. You said this earlier. I don't think any of us knew that it would. I mean, we were always concerned that it would lead to the end of the college, but that and I would just like to put this into a context. I mean, St. Rose is not the only small liberal arts college closing across the country. I mean, this is happening at a mm-hmm. at a record rate, which we can talk about in a larger context. But I do. You know, I got the tap on the shoulder when I got laid off from there. You know, that was sort of that was when I found out. But the idea that as you go forward and figure out what you do with a section of real estate, pretty much from, well, I mean, it brings you up to almost the park to, you know, practically Stuyvesant Plaza. I mean,
No. I mean, it is a much more concentrated real estate issue. Certainly the financial impact of not having those students, I agree with you.
And the stores, I mean, that's enormous.
Well, and I think I had assumed, and shame on me for assuming, but it was my understanding that for any school to close, you had to give a full academic year's notice. And I think that is one of those things, like, you never want to see that happen. You know, when you have the notice for a full academic year, it provides that much more runway and that much more time to have the discussions, to do the advocacy, to see how you can create as soft a landing as possible. So I think the thing that all of us are kind of reacting to is that it's at the end of, we're at the end of the semester.
Yep.
And we have some students here who have finals, so they probably want to get out of here. But you know, we're at the end of the semester, and there's only one semester to go. And so having that short of a runway, I think, is what we're all reacting to. And those are those are the circumstances that have been laid at our feet, so we got to deal with it.
Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan on the Roundtable panel on Friday, December 1st. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are posted online at WAMC.org and are available via podcast or in our app. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.